This is the news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, March 14th. We're discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Gilda Geist. We'll check in with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. And we'll speak with Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. A new Sagamore Bridge is in the works, and now some neighbors near the existing bridge have received notice that the state plans to take their properties to clear the path for building a new bridge. And Representative Bill Keating finds himself in the national spotlight after speaking out on behalf of a fellow member of Congress. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with those stories and more. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
For some people who live near the Sagamore Bridge, it has been a difficult time. What do we know about these letters they received and how many properties are involved?
These letters deal with what's called right-of-way acquisition, which in plain language means that in many cases, maybe not all, but many, the state will take the property by eminent domain. Rights-of-way can also include temporary easements for construction, but what we've reported on more is this kind of troubling story for at least several families, which is that the state is planning to take their homes and demolish them to build the new Sagamore Bridge. Letters covering all those different forms of right-of-way and land taking went to 15 property owners near the Sagamore Bridge, of which 12 of those are residential and 3 are commercial. The letters came from the Department of Transportation. If listeners want to actually see a copy of that letter, we have an example of one of them embedded in the story on our website, along with a fact sheet from the state that went to homeowners as well that kind of explains some of the terminology and how the process works.
A little more than 2 years ago now, you spent some time in this neighborhood knocking on doors and speaking with residents about what a new bridge could mean for them. Describe the community here for us.
Sure. The main location we're talking about is off Sandwich Road on the Cape side of the bridge. There's a subdivision there called Round Hill. Some of the homes there have been there since the 1950s. It's mostly capes and ranches with a few other home designs in there as well. When I was there, I knocked on every door. I think it was about 18 doors. And I found 2 renters, but most people there are homeowners, and many of them have lived there for a really long time. In fact, 2 of the adult children of the original developer of that subdivision live there. So it is a meaningful place, you know, I think as a lot of us would say about the places where we live. They've been there a long time.
But even at that time, 2 years ago, you spoke to folks about the possibility of their homes or their properties being taken by eminent domain. Looking back at that, what stands out for you now as you remember those conversations?
Yeah, there's a lot of history there for people, of course. Some people talked about raising their kids there. Some of them are widowed and have memories of their spouse in the home. One woman who is in her 80s told me that she can see the bridge from her kitchen, and she used to see her husband's car crossing the bridge as he came home from work. She still looks out at that view now. But, you know, of course, if the state takes her house, she will not be doing that. And 2 of the residents I met, if they had to move, would most likely be looking for a wheelchair accessible home. And one woman said that financially, she probably would have no choice but to go into some kind of nursing facility if she left her home because she wouldn't be able to buy something else. So, you know, when you start to pile all of those things on, you can really see how deeply it's going to affect people's lives in a lot of practical ways, too, just beyond kind of the loss that you think of, you know, losing your home.
What happens next for these 15 property owners now that they've received notice from the state?
Well, the letter from the state asks them to contact the right-of-way office themselves to discuss it. I'm sure if they don't, the state will be following up. But at some point, an appraiser is supposed to go out and visit the properties so that the state can determine what kind of compensation people are going to get. They're supposed to also be eligible for relocation money, although that right now that information is pretty vague. And if they don't agree to the appraisal, there is a process to file an appeal. But the state, from the state's point of view, that appeal is about the amount. It's not about whether the home's being taken. By everything that I've seen, the state generally prevails in arguments about eminent domain. And then if they go through that appeal, families can go to court. Again, my understanding is that the outcome for that would most likely just be about the money, not about the decision to take the home.
And briefly remind us, what's our current expectation of the timeline to replace the Sagamore Bridge?
It is still a ways out. The bridge still has to go through permitting and design, and the state actually has not hired the design and construction team yet. There's various approvals, and that final approval from the state is not expected to happen until late 2027 or possibly early the next year. And then they are predicting 6 years of construction work, so we'd be looking at a completion date of 2034 probably.
Let's talk about Representative Bill Keating, who holds the 9th congressional seat, which encompasses Cape Cod and the islands and the South Coast. Keating made national headlines this week for a spontaneous exchange during a subcommittee hearing. For anyone who had a blanket pulled up over their head this week to avoid the news, describe what happened.
Sure. This House subcommittee is chaired by Representative Keith Self, who is a Republican from Texas. And it came to the point in the meeting where he was supposed to introduce Representative Sarah McBride of Delaware to speak. McBride is a Democrat, but more relevant here is that she is the first openly transgender member of Congress. Congressman Self, the chair, introduced her as Mr. McBride. That is misgendering. That is using the wrong gender language for a person, in this case, intentionally, which we know because Keating asked him to change it and he wouldn't. McBride said back to the chair, "Thank you, Madam Chairman." And this is where Keating comes in. Keating asks the chair to fix the introduction. He refuses. And then Keating very assertively challenges him and says, "Have you no decency?" and some other things, and that he would not continue to participate in the hearing if he didn't change it. And then at that point, the chair gavels that hearing to a close, and that's it.
It was quite a striking exchange, and it plays out fairly quickly in just about 1 minute. We have a link to it on our website. Anybody who wants to go and watch themselves if they haven't seen it. What kind of follow-up came from the participants themselves?
Well, for on Keating's part, we asked him to come on the air and he declined to do that. Representative Self, the chair from the hearing, when he was in the meeting, he kind of sputtered and said, "I'm following the standard set on the House floor," meaning following the practice of House Republicans thus far. Then on social media, he gave the language from President Trump's executive order on gender, which says that the government will only recognize two sexes and that gender identity cannot be separated from those. Representative McBride, she also wrote about it on social media, not really specifically calling out anyone from this incident, but she said that some colleagues' treatment of her does not diminish her gratitude to represent Delaware in Congress.
You reached out to get some local reaction to this. This is our congressperson speaking out on this. Tell us what you heard from local folks.
I spoke with Paula DeGree, who is a board member at PFLAG Cape Cod, and is also transgender herself. And she said she feels proud of Congressman Keating for speaking up. It does feel like a violation when someone is misgendered that way. And she says one thing in her view that's important here is that this is really part of a pattern of political targeting that's not just about gender identity. She says other minority groups are being targeted right now also, and she believes that Americans need to stand up for people who are being marginalized.
One more story here, and this is a particularly sad one. Tom Kerr passed away suddenly this week. For the past 15 years, he has served as the administrator of the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority. He was a state rep before that, and he held a number of other positions in public service. For people who may not be familiar, describe some of the ways he made an impact on our region.
Tom Kerr, as you said, was a state representative. He was elected in 1985 and served for 14 years. He was always a big advocate for public transportation. According to a conference bio I read on him, he was served on the Transportation Committee actually for his entire time in the legislature, and also chaired that committee. He was a supporter of commuter rail expansion. And people told me that he was the driving force behind bringing the Cape Flyer to the Cape, you know, that the weekend summer train. That he was kind of the driving force behind that idea. After that, after serving in the legislature, he went on to the executive branch. He was a deputy secretary in the transportation office, and he oversaw, among other things, the regional transit authorities. And then, of course, we know from there, he went on to become the administrator of the transit authority here on Cape Cod, which operates our buses, the dial-a-ride service, and something that was more recent that I know he was very proud of, which was an app-based kind of ride-hailing type service that he introduced that was part of the regional transit system.
Yesterday, you reached out to a number of people who knew Tom and worked with him. Tell us a little bit about what you heard and what stood out as they remembered him.
Well, I would say the biggest theme really was people talked about how engaged and caring he was on so many different issues. You know, also, I mean, often it was transportation, but it was other things too that he worked on, open space and other things. Paul Nedzwicki, who is the CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, said that Kerr was, he says, basically single-handedly responsible for getting the elimination of the Sagamore Rotary to improve traffic. And as Wiki said, you know, that was actually a big contribution to the bridge project, too, because without the rotary, it was more clear that the bridge was a problem on its own, too. It wasn't just the rotary. people talked about how important care was, again, in bringing the Cape Flyer here. And they said that after he left state government, he was still the kind of guy who would help people with things that they needed. Like, he was doing constituent services for the public, even though he wasn't in office anymore. And Wendy Northcross, I spoke to as well. She's the director of the Kennedy Museum and also formerly from the chamber. And she said, like, not only did he get a lot done himself, but he was really also very generous in giving credit to other people. I saw him do that in different speeches and things that he gave, and that certainly was true.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Last Friday afternoon, scientists and science advocates gathered at the waterfront in Woods Hole as part of a series of national rallies called Stand Up for Science. CAI's Gilda Geist was there and joins us to tell us about the event. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Steve.
This was about raising voices against the recent cuts in science from the Trump administration, but also about a sense that science research may be in jeopardy.
Yeah, so this rally in Woods Hole, like you said, was one of many Stand Up for Science rallies that took place all over the country last Friday. It was organized by a group of scientists along with a bunch of volunteers, and this was all in response to cuts made by the Trump administration to science institutions. So NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, saw hundreds of scientists and meteorologists fired. And, of course, we have NOAA offices right here in Falmouth, including a lab in Woods Hole. We don't have an exact count, but we know a number of NOAA people were fired locally. And then the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the Woodwell Climate Institute, and the Marine Biological Laboratory, all in Woods Hole, they received millions in federal funding for scientific research, which is now in jeopardy. So a lot of changes underway. There's still a lot of uncertainty, and the rallies were meant to convey just how many people around the country support federal funding for science and appreciate the work that scientists do.
So tell us about the rally itself. We know Woods Hole has five major science institutions. Science work here accounts for something like 2,000 jobs on the Upper Cape. There's a lot at stake here.
Yeah, for such a small village, a lot of people turned out for this rally. A lot of retired scientists, some current scientists, and a lot of supporters. One person I talked to said she counted about 600 people. By my view, it was at least 400. But for those who were there, they were energized, they were excited to show their support for science, and they were also excited to show their disdain for the Trump administration's proposed cuts.
And a lot of creative handmade signs.
Yes, definitely a lot of people came prepared with their homemade signs. Some of them got pretty creative with it. One person had a collage they had done of Mar-a-Lago underwater. Of course, that's a reference to climate change and sea level rise. Someone else had a sign that said, "Grab them by the data," which is, of course, a callback to one of President Trump's most famous lines, which I cannot repeat here. I also saw someone with a baby in a stroller with a sign placed by the baby's feet that said, "My future depends on science." So people were having fun with it. Most of the rally was centered around a series of speakers, including the Woodwell Climate Research Center's Dr. John Holdren. He served as science advisor to former President Barack Obama. The crowd also heard from elected officials like Congressman Bill Keating, and there were about six speakers total.
What was the message that the crowd heard?
So I think mainly people heard that they were not alone in being disturbed or alarmed by these cuts. No matter what's happening in the federal government, the rally showed that people do care about science and they do want their tax dollars to go to scientific research. Woodwell Climate Research Center's president, Max Holmes, he was one of the speakers. He spoke about a colleague who was attending a Stand Up for Science rally in France that day and was talking about how they might create opportunities for American scientists to do their research abroad, which is to say, even outside of the U.S., people are alarmed at what's going on with science in the U.S.
Obviously, a lot at stake here. Sometimes we forget that science is really about humans, too. There has been a great push in recent years to open the doors of science wider, efforts to bring in scientists and students who have traditionally not found it very inviting.
Yeah, so this was brought up first at the rally by Jim Newman, a Woods Hole resident and retired engineer who has worked with several of the science institutions here. He was one of the last speakers, and he talked about how for a long time, opportunities to contribute to the sciences were reserved mostly for white men. The Woods Hole science community recognizes this and has been trying to address this issue. And one of the ways they did that was through a program called the Partnership Education Program. That's a summer program that gives opportunities to college students from underrepresented groups to come to Woods Hole and be immersed in the scientific community and make connections. However, now that program has been cut as well.
So concerns about both the funding and the jobs and even sort of the overall picture of science and what science looks like going forward. Let's talk about another story, also science related in its way. Barnstable County has announced it will now be able to test its own water samples for PFAS contamination. Why is this important?
Yeah, so first I'll just remind folks, PFAS, that's a group of chemicals you may know as forever chemicals. They got that nickname because it takes an absurdly long time for these chemicals to degrade in the environment. And of course, the problem with that is that PFAS has been linked to some pretty serious health impacts. So here on Cape Cod, we know there's PFAS contamination in at least some of the drinking water. Barnstable County Commissioner Mark Forrest said this is a problem that virtually every town on the Cape is dealing with in one way or another. So the Barnstable County Water Quality Lab Director, Dan White, explained this to me. Most of us, we're on town water, which means it's being tested regularly by professionals and has to meet certain standards. But some households on Cape Cod get their drinking water from their own private wells. And in those cases, the burden of testing falls on the well owner. So before the service was available through Barnstable County, it was very expensive and very challenging to get your well water tested for PFAS. But now people can do it right here on Cape, and it's faster and cheaper than they could get it anywhere else nearby.
Explain a little bit more about how this works. What had to happen for the lab here in Barnstable County to get this certification?
Yeah, so White told me his lab had been working on this for years. The state makes you do a lot of testing before they'll certify you for PFAS analysis, and that's simply for the purpose of quality control. There's also one particular scientific instrument that labs need to be able to do PFAS analysis. It's called a liquid chromatography mass spectrometer, and with the right procedures, this instrument can detect PFAS down to the teeniest, tiniest concentration, 2 parts per trillion. That's like looking for a needle in a haystack, basically. But with the right equipment, skills, and procedures, labs like ours in Barnstable County can detect even those tiniest amounts of PFAS. A chemist who works at the Barnstable County Water Quality Lab who actually runs this mass spectrometer called it the Ferrari of instruments.
The Ferrari of water quality testing. I love it. And if people want to get their own water tested, how do they go about it?
Yeah, so all the information you need is on the county website, but if you search Barnstable County Water Quality Laboratory on Google, you'll find the lab's webpage, and then if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see a big notice that says, now available, PFAS monitoring, and that has all the info. But just going over the basics, it's $265 per sample. The lab gives you a kit that you use to collect your sample. Then you bring it back, the lab tests it, and within 2 weeks, they'll have your results, and they can help you interpret them.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A plan to cut as much as 175 acres of white pine trees in a state park on Martha's Vineyard has raised concerns with some island residents. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
This plan has been around for a while, but this week it got a fresh public hearing. Explain the general idea here, and then we can talk about the different reactions.
Sure, yeah. So for folks who don't know kind of the geography of the island, kind of right smack dab in the center, we have this 5,300-acre forest. And it's kind of this very rare habitat. It's called a sand plain grassland. It's one of the few kind of last bastion in the world for this kind of habitat. But also within the forest, we have this kind of dense area of these white pines. And so they want to get rid of some of the white pines to kind of make way and kind of preserve this historically rare and kind of very biodiverse area.
One of the things that the folks who are behind this plan are saying is that the white pines are not native. They were planted here intentionally some years ago to create a lumber industry. Is that right?
Yeah, in the early 1900s, they were put there as part of kind of an idea to kind of start this island lumber industry. That kind of eventually petered out, and by the end of the century, you know, we kind of have these pines kind of really taking root in this area. And one of the big concerns for people who are supportive of the plan is that these kind of pines will continue to spread throughout the forest and kind of choke this kind of historic rare area.
For people who have grown up on the island in the last few generations, the forest has always seemed to have white pines. So this must seem like quite a shock to think that they're just going to go clear acres and acres and acres of these.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, you know, it is a forest. And so the idea of cutting trees is it's hard to wrap their minds around. So this has definitely gotten some pushback here on the island. Some people, you know, they're saying, you know, we have this kind of very large area of forest, and this is just kind of a small corner of it. It's in the southeast corner near in Edgartown. And so it's kind of, why are we kind of tolling that if this is something that people really love? It's, you know, it's something we have that, you know, a place like Nantucket and other areas don't really have. We kind of have this weird dichotomy.
Describe the meeting that happened this week. Who was running it, and what was some of the public reaction they heard?
Sure. We have a task force here on the island that's run by the Martha's Vineyard Commission. It's got ecologists, biologists, firefighters. This plan is proposed by the State Department of Conservation and Recreation. So they were kind of leading the meeting, kind of explaining the plan and kind of how it would roll out. And a lot of folks, it was a lot of back and forth. It went nearly 3 hours, people kind of asking questions. And, you know, it's kind of split here on the island. A lot of people who want it kind of to slow down, and kind of the state says, you know, well, we've been talking about this for several years now. So yeah, there's a lot of questioning, a lot of people wondering kind of why.
And the next step here for the clearing effort would be to kind of do some smaller versions of it. Is that right? To understand what the impact is on the land?
Yeah. First, DCR is kind of finalizing their plan, and then they're going to have to kind of run it up the chain. But yeah, the initial idea is they're kind of looking at it's about 79 acre parcels. In total, and kind of do some small cuttings in there to kind of see how it goes. One of the concerns is, all right, if we cut these all down, what happens after that? Do other things kind of rush in there now that it's more available that could be worse than pine? So they're hoping to test it out. It could maybe start later this year, early next year. It's still a little bit up in the air.
And for the public that wants to slow this down a little bit or still have an opportunity to comment, what happens next in that process?
Yeah, so the state has a comment period open until the 26th of March. This plan is kind of required by the state, so I don't know how much it will really change, but they're listening to the public on this, taking kind of comments, and then the state will decide how it wants to move forward.
Mm. Folks looking to comment here, what's a good place for them to weigh in?
It'll be on the DCR website, and we'll also have it on our website to find.
That is Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read all about it. Ethan, thanks so much.
Yep, thanks, Steve.
The Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission finds itself once more facing an uncertain future under the new Trump administration. Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle can help us understand what's happening. Hi, Ryan.
How are you, Steve?
This committee has been around since, really, I guess, the creation of the National Seashore in the early 1960s, but many people may not be familiar with it. Start with a description of its intended role. Like the name says, it's an advisory commission.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that word advisory is pretty important. So they don't have the sort of teeth or authority to enact policy on their own. But they are a good soundboard for the seashore staff. They work closely with seashore staff to kind of give recommendations and suggestions on things relevant to the management of, the seashore, which is, 40 plus miles of shoreline from Harwich really all the way out to Provincetown. So, again, they're not, kind of stamping and approving and voting on they're not creating policy, but they do have historically, they've had a very important role in kind of working closely with the seashore staff.
So now, I guess one thing people could know here is that under the previous administration, this commission was dissolved or was not allowed to meet, I guess.
Yeah, so that's sort of kind of been the history of the commission. Support for its work has sort of wavered in some cases from one presidential administration to the next. As you mentioned, back in 2016, the commission's legislative authority to convene had expired. The Trump administration declined to renew it. So for the majority of the Trump's first term, 2016 to 2020, they did not meet. That was overturned when President Biden took office, and in 2021 he reconvened the body, and they continue to meet. But there's kind of a pall that's hanging over everything because the thought among commission members that we spoke to is that, given past precedent, it's entirely likely and maybe in some ways anticipated that they could be sidelined once again.
You spoke to a number of the commission members here. Explain some of what they told you about the importance of the work they're doing and why they feel like it's not a good idea to sideline this commission now.
Yeah, so part of it is you have to look at the makeup. It's an 11-member body, which includes six members from representatives from each town in which the seashore resides or is active. Mark Forrest, county commissioner, he's an alternate member on the commission. He made that point that you need that sort of stakeholder input. You want that input from the communities. They need to have a seat at the table in some regard when it relates to, seashore operations, especially considering there are pockets of land in there that aren't, throughout the seashore that aren't necessarily under the seashore's jurisdiction that still reside within the purview of the towns. So that's a big part of it. You know, the argument is the towns really do deserve to have some kind of say or input about, you know, how this, you know, this park operates. So this is a park that brings in, you know, millions of dollars a year in revenue from visitors. And, you know, towns, their argument is that towns deserve to have some sort of say in how it operates.
Exactly what I was going to say. The park brings in your article, says brings in close to $540 million in annual revenue to the region. So the towns have a huge stake in how the park operates and how it interacts with the adjoining towns and the surrounding towns there. To have this commission sort of sidelined takes a big part of that conversation away. What's the sense of what happens next here?
It's a lot of wait and see, which is really kind of frustrating. Again, I think in some cases, people are anticipating it's just a matter of time, in their opinion, before, you know, the order is actually given for them to disband. It's worth noting that a few weeks ago, President Trump signed an executive order effectively dismantling other advisory commissions under other federal agencies. So on some level, this is kind of the wheels are already in motion. But you know, if this comes to pass and that is the case, you know, Rich Delaney, who's the chair of the commission, said they're going to kind of do what they did the last time, which is, you know, make an appeal to legislators and congressional leaders and say, what can you do to maybe help us overturn, you know, this decision and allow us to continue to meet. But with the, you know, makeup of Congress, it sounds like that might be a tough sled.
And we should mention that the park, National Seashore, is part of the National Park Service. It's already seen cuts and probably expecting to see more. There's a lot of uncertainty here. Ryan Brave, the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
In Provincetown, a rare property is for sale, one of the last remaining open sites on the town's waterfront. But it's complicated. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent has the story for us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
This lot, it turns out, could actually be considered three parcels, and one of them contains a beloved local market. Describe the setup for us.
Of course. So at 467 Commercial, out in the East End, you've got this sandwich shop that sells, you know, light groceries, wine, everything you need for a cocktail party, stuff you need to cook breakfast, all the basics. And it's been a market it's been in the Bryant family's hands since 1945. It was actually their uncle before that. So it's been a market since, I think, around 1905. Really a key place where the East End gathers in the morning and gets its coffee and muffins and, you know, some supplies for the day, your local news, your gossip with your friends.
And this is Angel Foods is the name of it.
Yes, yes. Since the mid-90s, it's been Angel Foods, run by Liz Lavati.
And adjoining the market is an open space where people can park, and it's open right to the water, which is kind of a rarity.
Yes. Many years ago, there was a wharf. There's never really been buildings on that particular part of the property. So it's a giant shell parking lot. There's a blacksmith shop, a little shed that George Bryant put up many years ago. But, yeah, it's views clear to the water. And right now it's used, you know, people will go out and have their sandwich and sort of chat by the ocean. But, you know, it's one of the very, very last open waterfront parcels in town.
Just by definition of it being one of the very last open parcels facing the water there, it has a real preciousness to it in the way that it's interacted with the surrounding community all these years. That could change depending on what happens here.
Yeah. So it's listed for, I believe, $6.4
million. $6.4 million. Okay.
And the obviously, when you're in this part of Provincetown's very dense downtown core, the redevelopment potential is enormous. You know, setback requirements are not very high. Lot coverage requirements are very generous. You know, Provincetown, if you walk the streets, you know, these buildings are all very close to each other, 2.5, 3 stories tall. You can build a lot on a half acre of waterfront. So that price of 6.4 is representing numerous condos that could be put into that space, or any number of other, you know, mixed use commercial with condos above, other kinds of things.
And the potential for the market going away, which is a little bit of a community anchor there.
Yeah, obviously people are worried about that. And there is an effort by some neighbors to try to round up the money that it would take to either possibly just buy the market building, possibly buy the market and the parking lot to keep it as an open and available space. There's even some discussion, you know, the Mary Heaton Vorth house, which was up for sale and bought also for its real historic value. She was a local author in town who has sort of a legendary status here in Provincetown. It's right across the street. It does a lot of arts programming. It does some really interesting community events. So there's a thought that by having this open space across, you could extend some of that arts programming to the waterfront. So that conversation is ongoing as people try to decide whether they can round up the money to pay the market price.
And when you say people, these are immediate neighbors, people at that end of town who just feel like they don't want to see a condo development kind of plug the hole toward the waterfront?
I think that's pretty accurate. One of the immediate neighbors, Ken Folk, is the person who helped organize the purchase of the Vorth House, which now does all that community arts programming. So, you know, there's a lot of people in that district who feel that the place is special and feel that they might be able to do something towards saving it. You know, we quote Ken in the story as saying he's optimistic that they can come up with something. And, you know, time will tell if that particular price can be met to try to conserve what's there now.
This really represents the way some of the pain of what happens when property, generational property, changes hands here, because this is a family that's owned it for a long time. But now there's a number of different family members with a stake, and that's part of why they're thinking of breaking it up into three separate parcels. It's something that's been playing in this manner, plays out again and again.
Yeah, and it really, in a way, the fact that it's a large enough lot at almost a half acre to split does create some more possibilities, because there is, you know, George Bryant's brother is still alive. He's interested in keeping it in family hands. George Bryant's two sons, you know, have an interest in selling and using the money to do other things in their own life. So splitting it three ways raises the possibility that George's brother might keep his part and the sons might be able to sell theirs. So there's a lot of variables in how it could unfold.
It's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. A popular Nantucket restaurant is closing to be replaced by an 8-lot subdivision. That's the plan anyway. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current has details on this and more from the island. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
We're talking about the Fairgrounds restaurant. There's a lot of fondness for it. Very much of a community restaurant, it sounds like.
Exactly. We're all, including myself, at one hand heartbroken for this, also very happy for Bill and Kim Pooter, who are the owners, who have run it for decades and have just done so much for the community through this restaurant. They've hosted countless events, funeral wakes, just tons of stuff for the community. But this restaurant and this property is proposed to be combined with an adjacent property and converted from its current use as a restaurant into an 8-lot housing subdivision. And so, you know, just a lot of feelings and emotions in the community about this. You know, it's got notoriety off-island because this is the place where President Biden would come and get his Thanksgiving dinners when he would come to Nantucket, where Coach Bill Belichick likes to go. But locally, as everyone on Nantucket knows, this is, you know, as a planning board member, Joe Topham said, it's kind of like Cheers. It's where you go, where everyone knows your name. It's a local spot. Everyone, and it's open year-round and serves the year-round community. So it's going to be a big loss if this does come to fruition as an 8-lot housing subdivision.
There was a moment there when the Pooters were trying to hold on to the property or let it change hands and perhaps even build some housing behind the property. None of that, all those moving parts never really came together, I guess.
Yeah, 2 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago now, they put it on the market and announced and were trying to sell it to, you know, either the town, but they filed a subdivision plan back then that would have just converted the back half of the property into housing and retained the restaurant. They had lots of conversations with folks and trying to retain the restaurant and have a successor come in and run it, keep it, you know, mostly as it had been. Unfortunately, you know, the economics of Nantucket for a restaurant like this really are difficult. If you didn't get in, you know, years ago, so no deal came to fruition. And as a lot of people have said this week, once something like this on Nantucket, sort of a year-round, reasonably priced sports bar, goes away, it's probably not coming back. So it's a sad time for the community.
There's the loss of that, and then there's kind of the idea of what's coming in, which may rub some people a different way, in that it's a 8-lot subdivision that will be all market-rate houses.
Correct. So there's a deal agreement in place to sell it to a realty corporation that's controlled by a summer resident from Braintree. And the proposal is for 8 housing lots to be sold at market rate. So no sort of affordability component to the development, and probably likely would not be selling at prices that, you know, a year-round working family could afford. So, you know, the planning board was a little, you know, lamenting this change, but acknowledging that the Pooters did have done what they could to try to sustain and retain the restaurant in a sale. And also recognizing that, you know, of course, they're entitled to retire. They put in, you know, decades of work at this and really poured their heart and souls into it. And it's time for them to have in the next chapter. Mm.
Jason, also this week, agents of the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, and the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, were on the island and arresting a suspect. Tensions have been so high about this type of enforcement action since President Trump came into office. Tell us what we know about this incident.
Yeah, this was earlier this week. And what we know, we don't know a lot so far other than what the DEA New England Division has shared. And they had agents come over aboard a Coast Guard vessel and were, you know, looking for a suspect that they said was a violent offender. And they were serving a warrant, did locate this person and arrested one other woman. We don't know what the charges are or immigration status or not. We don't really know a lot about who these people are or why they were targeted for removal. But this is the first sort of immigration enforcement by federal agencies on Nantucket since the Trump administration has taken over in January. And as you mentioned, there had been rumors over the past couple months about ICE and other agencies coming to do immigrate. None of those were true, but it did send sort of fear through the immigrant community here on Nantucket. You know, we've heard about, you know, parents keeping their kids home from school, people not showing up at job sites. So this was sort of the realization of some of those fears. It wasn't a sort of widespread sweep or anything like that. It sounds like it was very targeted on someone who allegedly had a record of domestic assault and battery and kidnapping, according to the DEA. So we're going to continue to follow the case and see what more we can find out.
It's Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Workforce cuts from the Trump administration have already hit federal fisheries offices in New England. Many more are expected, and they seem to arrive on Fridays. We'll be keeping an eye out. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light took a look at the impacts of these cuts and the concerns they raise for the future management of the fishery. She joins us now. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what we know about what cuts have come down so far. Part of the challenge here is that it's not easy to get information about how many and which positions are being cut and whether the impacts, the potential impacts, have been considered.
Well, you got that right. My answer might not be satisfactory to some, but yeah, it's been really challenging to get any information on the one hand from the federal government, who will officially say they don't comment on personnel and they won't share how many people have been cut, the positions that they filled. And then you have people that were cut or are still working within the agencies that are really fearful to talk. And they've also communicated that the only information they get is from the media, or they're just hearing, you know, rumors. It's just kind of everyone's operating in this you know, black box and not really knowing what's happening. And so that makes it a lot harder to gauge the impacts, but we're still working on doing that.
One of the things we heard is that people who were working under probationary status were the first to let go. These are, and somebody unfamiliar with this may think that these are all just kind of new hires, but that's not necessarily the case because plenty of experienced folks can fall into that category.
That's right. Yeah, there's sort of a loophole where someone might be probationary, and just to define probationary doesn't mean you're in trouble. It's just, you know, you're new to the agency, you're new to the position. And so you could have had some people that were recently promoted that had been longtime employees of NOAA Fisheries, for example, or even contract workers where they weren't officially under the employ of the federal government, but they had been contracted to work there for many, many years. And so it's more of a formality that they're now an employee, but because they had only been in that position for 1 year, less than 1 year, even less than 2 years, they went on the chopping block.
I thought it was interesting. Bill Keating suggested that the lack of information around the firings and the job workforce cuts here is intentional. He says it's part of a strategy.
Yeah, I think many might agree with him. What we spoke to just a minute ago is it makes it hard to criticize perhaps the administration and also figure out, well, what are the impacts to these cuts going to be? There are going to be impacts. These are people that serve you know, important roles. They collect science that informs fisheries management. And so if you don't know who's being cut or what's changed, it makes it harder to, you know, hold one accountable or, you know, criticize and what have you. So, yeah.
We know New Bedford is a top dollar port here for its scallop fishery. The scallop fishery itself is dependent on a lot of these science regulators sort of doing their job. There's something called the scallop framework that needs to come out that allows them to fish. Explain the scallop framework.
Yep. So they pass it every year. It's based on, you know, data and science and surveys, but it essentially tells the fishermen how much they can fish for that year, where they can catch it, and what type of trips they can take. So they have a certain number of days at sea, but there's also these access area trips. It can get kind of complicated, but that's essentially what the framework does. And it has been delayed before. Scallop season starts on April 1st, and it is certainly going to be delayed this time around. And because of that, the fishery has to use what's called a default measure, which is less days at sea and less quota, and they operate under that until the framework is passed. And, you know, complicating its passage, of course, there's a new administration, but there are executive orders that Trump has passed. One requires that for every new regulation that's passed, the agency has to recommend, you know, 10 other regulations to repeal. And there are other orders that if a regulation might cost a certain amount of money or have a monetary impact, and that requires extra review. So it's sort of caught up in this bureaucracy and confusion of this new administration. And so right now, they're not going to have that framework in time for April 1st.
It sounds like from the science people you spoke to, and we have just a little less than a minute here, but there's been a real fear about a loss of continuity and institutional knowledge.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some fishermen will be critical of NOAA. They want it to be defunded. But the scientists that work there, they try their best to work with the fishermen and to use the most up-to-date science they can to inform, you know, where the stocks are, how healthy they are, and with the ultimate long-term goal that these fisheries be sustainable so the fishermen can continue to fish. And when that science isn't there, regulators will probably err on the conservative side, which means that the quotas they set are going to be smaller, which means fishermen can't catch as much. And so it's all really interconnected, and losing this institutional knowledge, scientists say, could have, you know, impacts for many years to come.
It's Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Anastasia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Gilda Geist, spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Ryan Bray of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Grazia of Nantucket Current and Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Big thank you to Dan Treidel for engineering the program as the News Roundup steers from story to story across the stormy sea of news. Dan Treidel peers to the far horizon, undaunted, keeping us on course. Thanks, Dan. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.